possible. A high today around 78, an overnight low of 66. If you're on a Lake Michigan beach today, watch out for high waves and dangerous currents. For tomorrow, a continuing chance of showers and storms. Tomorrow's high 77, breezy with north winds during the afternoon hours, gusting as high as 25. Then back to dry weather for Wednesday and Thursday with highs in the 70s. Right now, clouds and 73. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission at Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. Newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be exploring the life and significance of a largely forgotten early American who, in fact, played a pivotal role in the emergence of what eventually became the United States of America. The book at hand is called Founding Martyr, The Life and Death of Dr. Joseph Warren, the American Revolution's Lost Hero. It is the contention of the author of this book, Christian D'Espigna, and he backs up the contention very impressively in his meticulously researched book, that Dr. Joseph Warren, had he not perished in 1775, would be remembered in the same breath with other founding fathers such as George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and so on. But because he was tragically killed, he is largely forgotten, and his enormous significance not fully appreciated. Christian D'Espigna has done a great service to all Americans by helping us to better understand who Dr. Joseph Warren was and the pivotal role that he played in the rebellion that led to revolution, that ultimately led to the formation of a new nation. The book, again, is called Founding Martyr, The Life and Death of Dr. Joseph Warren, the American Revolution's Lost Hero. The author, Christian D'Espigna, is a writer based in New York City and Williamsburg, Virginia. He is someone who works regularly and speaks frequently on behalf of Colonial Williamsburg. And this book is published by Crown. Christian D'Espigna, we welcome you to the morning show.
Gregory, I appreciate you having me on the show. Thank you.
I've really enjoyed your book very, very much. I did not know this name at all. And I'm glad I know the name and a lot now about the story of Dr. Joseph Warren. Do you remember when you first became aware of Dr. Joseph Warren and his significance? Can you trace that to any particular moment? And at what moment did you begin to realize that this was a story that was worthy of being told in a wider way?
It kind of goes back to the late 90s. I was on a vacation with my wife at the time, and we had stopped in this little bookstore on our way to Block Island, Rhode Island, and it was a secondhand bookstore. And I found this book, and it was called Stories About General Warren. And it turns out it had been written in the mid-19th century by a niece of his. And I remember thinking, I've never heard of this person. Who is this? And, you know, I kind of looked into it and started reading some books on him. And then when the publication of Paul Revere's Ride by David Hackett Fisher came out, Warren's name was scattered throughout the entire book. And I remember thinking, yeah, I don't understand. His name is everywhere, but yet we're getting a sentence here and a sentence there, and he seems so important, and his fingerprints seem to be on all these events in colonial Boston, but yet there's really not much information on him. So I tracked down a biography that had been written in 1865 by Richard Frothingham, and it was really the first biography written on Warren. I mean, there were a couple of pieces written on him, a few magazine pieces, journal pieces back in the early 19th century, but that was really the first major biography written on him, and then there was not a biography written on him for another 100 years after that. So when I began the research, there were really only two biographies, and it really puzzled me, particularly since the second biography in 1961 by a John Carey kind of made a statement, and I'm quoting offhand here, but he said, a personal belletristic biography of Dr. Warren cannot be written, and this book is intended as a second look at his public career. And part of the issue was it's kind of a catch-22, Gregory. So you're saying on one hand, well, there's such a dearth of primary source documents concerning Dr. Warren, but then again, there are some documents that chronicle his public career. And I was fortunate throughout the course of these 20 years of research to come across a lot of documents that had either gone unnoticed or undiscovered or discovered now that I was able to find some. But it really kind of started in the late 1990s, early 2000s, where I came across that book, like I said, and just really became fascinated that someone so pivotal was so unknown.
I wonder if you could say a word about some of the primary sources that you were able to track down or uncover that you found to be especially valuable. And I want to be sure that you talk in particular about some of the medical records or doctor records that you were able to access and why they were so valuable for you in this undertaking.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess the largest two repositories of primary source information are at the Massachusetts Historical Society and the Boston Athenaeum. And at MHS, they have Joseph Warren's medical journals, which chronicles his patient lists, what he's being paid, what he's administering. And I was fortunate because even though these books had been referenced before, being in Colonial Williamsburg, I was able to connect with a Sharon Kottner, who has been working at the apothecary shop in Colonial Williamsburg for, I think, close to three decades. And when you first look at these journals, it kind of looks like ancient hieroglyphics. There's Latin abbreviations, there's denotations that you really can't understand. So I made copies of these documents and brought them to her, and it was amazing. She pulled out this huge tome and started helping me to deconstruct it page by page and said, okay, this is an abbreviation for this, and this is what he's administering, and he's mixing this, and these are the services he's performing. And after a while, it starts to sort of unravel, put together like a puzzle piece, and you start saying, wow, so he's doing this, he's administering these medicines, and the other journals that are located at the Boston Athenaeum are basically chronicling everything he's buying from a Boston apothecary by the name of Greenleaf. And so in there, he's buying all kinds of odd things. He's buying things called glister pipes and syringes and papers. And you're just starting to see that this is more than a medical practice. So he's not only administering treatments, he's making his medicines. He's selling things. He's taking things in trade instead of just payment. From one of his sources, he's receiving beer and flour and shoes in return for his services. And I think more importantly, I was able to come across some material culture pieces. So I was able to find, and newspapers were particularly helpful. And what I did was I went through literally tens of thousands of newspapers searching for any information on the Northeastern Seaboard that would mention Warren. And in one, I found that he had had a piece of mourning jewelry made when his wife passed away. And this was significant because mourning jewelry was popular in the day, but scholarship has kind of told us that, or at least suggested that Warren married his first wife based on financial gain. And by finding this mourning ring, you're able to see that, no, this goes way beyond financial gain. Warren had four children with his wife. She passed away at an early age, leaving him a widower with four young children to raise. And the ring is particularly significant because it shows Warren's elevated social status within the Boston community. So there's 16 stones around the ring. And you're talking about someone who has to be in an elevated financial position to be able to afford something like that. So I was able to come across that as an example. I was also able to come across a bracelet that his wife had made woven with Warren's hair that showed that they, you know, did have a very close, intimate relationship, that the marriage was based on more than financial gain. So it wasn't just coming across these newspapers and these medical journals, but it was also these material culture pieces that kind of help put the puzzle together a little bit.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Christian DiSpigna about his book, Founding Martyr, The Life and Death of Dr. Joseph Warren, the American Revolution's Lost Hero. Dr. Warren was a pivotal figure in that period just ahead of the Revolutionary War. And his death at Bunker Hill in 1775 is one of the reasons why his name does not live on in the same way as the names of other early Americans who survived the Revolutionary War and lived into the early years of this new nation. And Christian DiSpigna's book really helps right a wrong by bringing Dr. Warren's name back into the prominence, which it really deserves. In your book, you explore a bit about Joseph Warren's family background and childhood. And one of the things that's probably most important for us to say about him is that he was the son of a farmer and no stranger to hard work. And I glean from what you write about these early years of Joseph Warren that this was very significant in shaping the man that he grew up to become.
And I think one of the fascinating things was when he does become accepted at Harvard, he's ranked, I believe it was 25th in a class of, I think, 40-something people. So he's towards the bottom end of the social scale. And at that time, Harvard's ranking is based on the social status of one's parents. So even though Warren's father owned a farm and was a selectman in Roxbury, Massachusetts, we see that Warren is definitely not part of this young men of elite students at Harvard. And I think one of the fascinating things about studying some of his primary source documents at Harvard was that in his junior and senior year, Warren is rooming with two of the top scholars from his class. And what's interesting about that, Gregory, is that usually if you're ranked at the bottom of the social scale, you're rooming at Harvard with other students at the bottom of the social scale. So it just says something about Warren in his early years that he's sort of able to elbow out of that mediocrity and that stigma that he's from a lower social class status than most of the elite students there. And as an example, the top student at the time was the son of Connecticut's governor, Jonathan Trumbull. So it kind of gives you an idea who's at the top of that list and how Warren was when he entered as a freshman at Harvard. But I think it speaks to Warren as the individual and how you can see the sort of early social rise even back then when he's at Harvard.
Right. And if I remember correctly, I think you tell us that he was also fairly small of stature as well, which made him a very inviting and convenient target for hazing, which was a reality back then as much as it is now. And in a sense, so this was one more hurdle for him to climb, in a sense, an indignity to endure, and he did. I mean, so he's a young man of perseverance even at this relatively early age.
it was kind of interesting to see how, you know, I guess we kind of look back at that colonial world and it's sort of out of touch with us now. But when you kind of go back to that world and you're reading and you're deconstructing the space and the time, it's kind of funny to see how maybe things have not changed that much in 200 some odd years, that there was still hazing and that the senior sophisters, as they were called, were still giving the freshmen a hard time, and the freshmen had all these chores and lists of things that they would have to do for the upperclassmen. But it really does speak to I think part of Warren's personality and kind of how you can see this rise at Harvard and how that's going to play out in later years with the revolutionary movement, with the Boston Patriots and the Whigs. But one of the most interesting things I was able to find was a reference in a newspaper that basically said that Warren was pulling all these pranks on his classmen. I mean, and we don't know the how true this really was. We don't know if this is another, you know, George Washington chopped down the cherry tree, but they have him nailing classmates' shoes to the floorboards and hanging crockery ware up so that when the door opened, it would crash to the ground. But it's just colorful stories that kind of give a little bit of a picture of what the times would have been like at Harvard. And I devote a chapter in the book to his Harvard years, which was very challenging because most works on Warren before this, basically it's you read a page or two about his years of Harvard. It's just, you know, in a way it's frustrating because you go into the project knowing that there's just not that much stuff, so it kind of takes years to try and find these things and cross-reference and get a story there. So, it, you know, in the end, it is satisfying, but it was definitely challenging to paint this picture of his years at Harvard. But I was lucky to find sources at Harvard that chronicled some of his roommates and some, again, the newspapers that talked about his nature as being an audacious prankster.
Right. And did I read correctly that when John Warren graduated from Harvard, he was just 18 years old?
Right. When Joseph Warren graduated, he was just 18 years old. Yes. And you know, it was when you look at all the ages of all his classmen, I think there was only one other student as young as he was. And at the time when Warren entered, he was 14. And I think out of all the other 45 freshmen, everyone, I think he was younger than, I think, probably about 95% of the other entering students. So he's not only the youngest, and he's not only at the bottom of the social scale, which is, it's you can just imagine the difficult position that he's entering into.
Right. It says a lot about him that he emerged from Harvard as successfully as he did. And you spend some time in the next chapter talking about the very impressive doctor with whom he apprenticed, one Dr. James Lloyd, whom you call one of Boston's most famous and pioneering physicians. Tell us a little more about Dr. James Lloyd, what made him so impressive, and what made him such a valuable mentor for young John Warren.
And this is also part of the Warren story, because just to preface it a little bit, Gregory, most sources, most histories claim that Sam Adams was Joseph Warren's mentor, his political mentor, his mentor, and keep in mind that Warren's father died when he was 14. So what I found from the research was that the real mentor was Dr. James Lloyd, and Lloyd had trained over in Europe with some of the most well-known surgeons and physicians at the time. There were a couple in Scotland that he trained with that were kind of at the time doing cutting-edge techniques in medicine. Given the period, there's no real obstetricians delivering babies. Basically, if a woman's pregnant, she's under the care of a midwife. So when Lloyd is over in Europe learning these techniques and training as a physician, he's learning these techniques. So when he comes back to the colonies and sets up shop in Boston, he's performing these techniques, and he's delivering babies. So when Warren goes into his household, I think this was a pivotal moment in Warren's life, because not only is Warren training with one of the best physicians at the time, because Warren's family was not able to afford to send him to Europe, and there is no medical school training. There's no Harvard Medical School at this time. Warren was fortunate to get an apprenticeship with Lloyd. And not only that, so Warren is in Lloyd's household. And he's not only learning these techniques, but he's also getting the social skills. I mean, Lloyd is a horticulturalist. He's wealthy. He's entertaining Boston's elite. So Warren's learning about fine dressing and, you know, the finer things in life, luxury. So when Lloyd takes Warren under his wing, it's just, it's more than a medical apprenticeship, which is significant in and of itself. Mm-hmm. But Warren's also learning how to become a gentleman, which is very, very important in Boston society, and which is also giving Warren a boost because he is a Harvard graduate. So he's coming from this farming background, and now he's got a Harvard degree, and he's training with one of the finest gentlemen and physicians in Boston, which is really going to set Warren on a trajectory to succeed and become one of Boston's elite citizens. So I really think that that was a pivotal chapter in his life, and it kind of predates his relationship with Samuel Adams. So
right.
I think Lloyd becomes more than his more than a doctor who's training him. He sort of becomes a father figure to Warren and sort of takes him under his wing. So I really thought that was important.
Right. And if anything, he is an even more important mentor to Joseph Warren than Samuel Adams is, or certainly equally important for certain.
I try to make that case, yeah.
Yeah, I think you make it persuasively. You also tell us that not only was it really significant that at one point you say Joseph Warren had chosen his mentor wisely. So it sounds like, at least to some extent, it was Joseph Warren who chose Dr. Lloyd, although Dr. Lloyd, I'm sure, had to agree to serve as his apprentice. But that was not only propitious, but also, in a sense, the timing. You tell us, as Joseph Warren dove into his apprenticeship, events were unfolding in Boston and London that further divided the two cities. So beginning in 1760, we're talking about a very tumultuous period in Boston's history. You tell us it is ravaged by social strife, economic hardship, political upheaval, and then an outbreak of smallpox. So in a sense, what an important time to be a doctor in a city like Boston. Describe to our listeners what these years were like, the very first years beginning in 1760, what life was like in Boston and what life was like for young Joseph Warren.
So Warren graduates in 1759, and this is at the height of the Seven Years' War. And so there's a lot of pride happening in Boston, because remember, I mean, we're not Americans at this point. We're still British subjects under crown rule. And so when the end of the Seven Years' War happens, what happens is there's an economic downturn in Boston. And I think one of the most significant things socially in Boston is that Boston is, in 1760, is ravaged by a horrific fire that destroys something like 400 buildings. So when this smallpox outbreaks happens, now keep in mind that there have been smallpox outbreaks before this. I mean, particularly in 1721, there was a nasty one. And there was a lot of controversy because smallpox inoculations were not a popular method at this point, because basically what you're doing is you're actually infecting the person with the smallpox so that they get it with that with the infection, not naturally, which is going to increase their chances of surviving it. But this is almost an outrageous thought at this time by a lot of people who are in Puritan Boston, who the majority of people are thinking that, well, this is God's divine punishment for people who are bad. This is, you know, it's the time of the Renaissance. Things are happening. Medicine is starting to develop and become a little more professional. So Warren kind of, it's so important because he's coming of age within this time when so many important things are happening. And what's particularly significant about these smallpox inoculations is that when this outbreak happens in the winter of 1764, they set up an inoculation hospital at Castle William. And so basically Warren and several other physicians from Boston set up shop and are treating these patients. And, I mean, we can't even imagine the conditions. I mean, think about not only the odor, but just the recovery period is about 6 weeks. The people are sick. It's just, I can't even imagine what Warren was going through. And basically, he's a rookie physician, to put it in those terms. So he's really getting this experience when he's quite raw. I mean, he's just finishing up his apprenticeship with Lloyd, and he has to borrow money to set up shop, to buy beds and pillows and set up accommodations for these patients. And what was interesting of note is that John Adams and his brother come to Castle William in Boston Harbor to get inoculated. And one of the physicians with Warren inoculates Adams, and Warren inoculates Adams' brother. And the earliest description we have of Dr. Warren is from John Adams, who's describing Joseph Warren's mannerisms, his appearance when he's administering these smallpox inoculations. And when the epidemic is over in the summer of 1764, there's a newspaper article that basically comes out and says, you know, we owe so much to these doctors who basically saved the town, and basically lauding them as heroes. So it really, again, here's another incident that kind of catapults Warren into this role where he's graduating Harvard, he gets his apprenticeship, and then he's on the front lines of this smallpox epidemic.
Hmm. We're speaking with Christian DiSpigna, and we're talking about his book, Founding Martyr, The Life and Death of Dr. Joseph Warren, the American Revolution's Lost Hero. Dr. Joseph Warren was a very important figure in pre-revolutionary America, but a figure largely forgotten. And Christian DiSpigna's fascinating book helps us understand Dr. Joseph Warren's importance on many, many different levels. You spend some time talking about Dr. Warren's own medical practice, which takes off and quickly becomes one of the largest in Boston. And one of the things that you take pains to mention more than once is the fact that Dr. Warren treated both Whigs and Tories without prejudice. And it's important for us to kind of unlock the significance of this. So first of all, I think you need to spell out for our listeners what the great political divide was between Whigs and Tories at this point in time, and then what it meant for somebody like Dr. John Warren to be in such contact with both and to be treating both. So spell it out for
us. So Tories and Loyalists are basically colonists who are loyal to the crown, and Whigs and Patriots are colonists who are questioning crown policies that they deem oppressive. So we see this political divide start to happen in the early 1760s, and it just, the crack starts to get worse year by year. And I think it's worth mentioning that we talked about how significant Dr. Lloyd was in Warren's life. We have to keep in mind that Dr. Lloyd was a loyalist, which I think, again, speaks a lot about Warren's beliefs, that even though his mentor was a loyalist, that Warren did, I mean, by all rights, when you look at the history and you look at all the documents and you put all these pieces of the puzzle together about Warren, by all rights, it just seemed logical that he would have become a loyalist, because he's getting his start from Lloyd. You know, most, you know, in the beginning, his patients are these elite Boston loyalists, Thomas Hutchinson, the Olivers. And when Warren's at Harvard, a lot of his classmates are the sons of these loyalist leaders. So it's even more fascinating, Gregory, when you look at Warren's life, saying, how did he rise to become one of these, the most important Boston patriots? Because by all rights, he should have been a loyalist. But you see, the frustrating thing about his medical career was that, you know, we're grateful that the Massachusetts Historical Society has those two ledgers, but there's at least two that are missing that we know were in existence. And I was fortunate enough, about 10 years ago, I was able to find and buy at auction a portion of his lost medical ledger that detailed treatments about Christopher Monk, who is the sixth victim of the Boston Massacre, which I thought was fascinating. And within that auction lot, came that 1865 Frothingham biography, but there were also two letters written by an Ellis Ames documenting Warren's life and basically saying, and this was from the 1860s, that it's amazing that even in the 1860s, the handwriting of Warren is so scarce. But so finding that find was great. And just when you're seeing these medical journals and you're looking them over, you're seeing all these names appear and you're saying, okay, this was a loyalist and this was a loyalist and this was a loyalist. And this is in the mid-1760s, late 1760s. By the early 1770s, you see Warren is no longer treating these loyalist patients. That the divide and the fracture has just been broken too much. And you can definitely say with assurance that by those early 1770s that he is not treating these loyalist patients anymore, that he has become a dedicated Whig patriot in Boston.
So in a sense, when we look at this record, what we can really trace more than anything is Dr. Joseph Warren's own sort of personal evolution from loyalist to patriot.
Right, and we're seeing certain articles that he's writing in newspapers that are becoming more inflammatory. And we're seeing, you know, just for instance, the Samuel Adams question. Within Warren's one medical ledger, he's treating Samuel Adams. And the date, I believe, is June 27th. I think it's 1768. And Warren spells Adams' name wrong. But more than that, he lists Adam as the Honorable Speaker of the House of Representatives, but Adams was the House Clerk at the time. So you have to question, how close was Warren with Adams at this time? Because most histories tell us that, well, Samuel Adams was Warren's political mentor, and I don't question that. But you have to question, well, when did this start? And when you bring Lloyd into the picture and you realize by 1768, if he's not as close with Adams as was previously thought, you know, it just gives more credence to the fact that really Lloyd was his first mentor, but that Warren is also loaning Adams money at this time. I mean, there's a subscription taken up to give Adams money to help pay off his tax debts. And that's a whole other question that we can bring into this, which is the land bank controversy, which has affected Samuel Adams' father. And it also affected Warren's family, and I kind of traced this political divide to that. And what the land bank was quickly was, it was basically, since there was a scarcity of coin in New England, what people did was they started issuing banknotes to help pay debts. And this was not a good thing for Boston's elite and many of the loyalists. So it devolved into this controversy, and it basically financially ruined Adams' father and also Warren's maternal grandfather. And this really became a divisive issue early on between what starts to become loyalists versus Whigs.
Mm. I think this is important what you're saying, but I think you're also saying that there was a time when Joseph Warren was treating both Whigs,
yes,
and loyalists at the same time, and that in a sense, part of what made Joseph Warren such an important figure was because he had, in a sense, connections to both camps, perhaps even to some extent understanding of both camps or both schools of thought, unlike probably some of his peers who were so singularly rooted in one side or the other. And in a sense, Joseph Warren in a very uncommon, maybe even in a unique position to have the importance and influence that he did, that in a sense he was a part of or appreciative of both worlds. Is that fair to say?
Gregory, absolutely. I mean, the fact that Warren, it becomes an attractive figure because he has networks and connections on both sides. So it's not that Warren is some rabid revolutionary, as he's been depicted in the past at times, but this is someone who has friends on both sides of the political divide at this point. And it's just interesting to watch how the whole thing unfolds, because, you know, we've read recent histories talking about how the revolution just ruined families, how it divided them, and some family members chose to remain loyalists while others became Whigs, and it was horrific, gut wrenching that it destroyed families, and you kind of see this, that Warren does have these connections on both sides, so it brings him a legitimacy at such a young age, and that's what's even more fascinating when you compare him to these other Whig leaders in Boston. He's by far the youngest. I mean, we're talking about a highly stratified social society in Boston where it's not only based upon economic advantage, but also age. It's a deferential society, and Warren is very young for his age to start having these leadership posts as this divide continues to deepen between the colonists and Britain.
One of the things that is quite intriguing about Joseph Warren, as we start to enter these years now, just ahead of the revolution, as things start to really heat up in Boston and elsewhere, is that Joseph Warren is active in a number of different ways, in a number of different arenas. And many times you use the word ubiquitous to describe him and to describe his role in this new emerging nation. Why do we see that word so often, ubiquitous?
When you look back at what's happened, and I kind of look at Boston as a microcosm of what's happening in the colonies, because it's not just Boston that's having this resistance activity. I mean, it's happening in Williamsburg, Virginia. I mean, it's happening in seaports along the northeastern seaboard, but it's particularly resonant in Boston because of these major events that are unfolding. And it's just amazing because we see Warren is involved in every single one of these revolutionary events. I mean, take the Boston Massacre. I mean, Warren is in Boston the day it happens, and he's performing the autopsy on one of the victims. I mean, we see that from that missing ledger that I found that portion of, that he's treating the sixth victim of the Boston Massacre who dies years after from complications of the wound. We see that Warren is one of the authors who were writing that short narrative of the Boston Massacre that's being sent over to England as sort of a propaganda coup to reach people in Britain to kind of portray this event as a horrific massacre that happened at the behest of the British officers. I mean, when we see the Tea Party, there's no document that says Warren is at one of the ships dumping tea off the ship, but his fingerprints are everywhere. He's meeting with key people in the weeks leading up to the Tea Party. He's at Old South Meeting House the night the Tea Party occurs. I mean, he's just everywhere, and that's what's so fascinating, because how could this be? How could Warren be involved in all these events? How could he fight at the Battle of Lexington and Concord? How could he get killed at Bunker Hill? How can he deliver two Boston Massacre orations and nobody really knows about him? We've never been taught about him. It's inconceivable to me.
Right, exactly. You say he was a propagandist, a polemicist, author, orator, professor, and then ultimately a major general, we'll get to that, as well as a doctor, a mentor, a spy master. I mean, he is active in so many different respects. I want to be sure to give you a chance to tell our listeners about something called the Greyhound, which was a tavern in Boston, and you describe it as an important socio-political center of discourse and learning. Not just the Greyhound, but other taverns as well. I think some of us have kind of a vague notion of this, but I really think you do a great job of helping us understand just what was going on in some of these places and how significant it was.
Right, and some of it's obvious, some of it's not so obvious. So when we think back to 18th century Boston, there's no radio, there's no TV. So where are the social hubs? And it's the taverns. And, you know, I guess today we think of a tavern, or we see these commercials with Sam Adams and the beer, and we think the founding fathers were these group of drunk people hanging out in taverns, but taverns were more than a place to eat or drink. I mean, taverns served as hotels. So if someone's traveling and they go to a tavern, they're able to lodge their horse there. They're able to sleep there. They're able to eat there. They're able to drink there. But what's so important about these taverns are you can get newspapers there, and you can mingle with other people there. And what's important about this, so when sessions of the general court are in session, when this is happening, everyone's converging at these taverns. So they're having slave auctions at taverns. They're having lottery tickets sold at taverns. They're collecting taxes at taverns. They're posting advertisements in taverns. They're holding balls in taverns. They're holding lectures in taverns. I mean, this is like the movie theater, the roller skating rink. I mean, this is all in one social hub here. And I think what's important about Warren is I think he recognizes this. He sees this at an early age, because the Greyhound was a popular tavern in Roxbury. And we, you know, Warren uses these taverns to the advantage of this rebellion movement, where he's organizing and he's doing this grassroots activism and he's bringing people into this Whig movement and he's talking to them. And you start to realize just how important these taverns were, and that it was not just a watering hole for people to drink and mingle, but it was just so much more than that. And particularly when these courts are in session, these are where the movers and shakers are getting together, and this is where you're able to rub elbow with these peoples and discuss the political events. So taverns really were important centers, you know, in colonial towns throughout the northeastern seaboard.
Right, and we just don't understand this period or what occurred if we don't understand this facet of early American life. I want to be sure to give you a chance to talk about Joseph Warren's hand in a document that you write signaled the transformation of the resistance movement into a rebellion. I believe that we are talking about a special document that really, in a sense, kind of crystallized some of the sort of building discontent that was really important. Tell us about this.
So I believe we're talking about the Suffolk Resolve.
Yes.
And basically this is a declaration and list of grievances, and it's rejecting the Massachusetts Government Act, which is calling for a boycott of British imported goods unless these intolerable acts are repealed. And what's happening is, as a result of the Tea Party, the British Parliament punishes the colonists by implementing these intolerable acts, and it's basically a series of laws that are passed to punish them. So one of the most devastating ones is that it closes the port of Boston on June 1st, 1774, which is basically putting a chokehold on Boston. And so what these Suffolk Resolves are is, it's like I said, it's a list of these grievances, and it's a declaration, and it's calling for a boycott of British imported goods. And what's so monumental about this is that Warren is the chief writer of this document, and he sends Paul Revere to the delegates at the First Continental Congress in Philadelphia, and they resolve it, they adopt it unanimously, which is unbelievable, because when you think about it, so here are all these men from all the different colonies, and they are harboring their own prejudices. They're hearing about Massachusetts as sort of this upstart, rebellious town in Boston that's causing these problems, and it's really, I mean, the atmosphere is somewhat divisive when these men first meet in Philadelphia. And the fact that what's so important about this document is, I mean, you see some of the language that shows up in the Declaration of Independence, but this, for me, this really unites these delegates. It's a common document that they can come together on, and the fact that it's resolved unanimously, to me, that was incredible. And just on that alone, Warren deserves a page in history.
Absolutely. This is how you describe it. On September 16th, Paul Revere arrived in Philadelphia with the Suffolk Resolves, and the following day the document was presented to the Continental Congress, whose members applauded as it was read aloud. They approved and adopted all of Warren's proposals unanimously. Remarkable under the circumstances. At one moment, the local Massachusetts boycott against British goods had become a unified colonial boycott. With several strokes of his quill, Warren's opus had unified the colonies in a critical step towards solidarity. We just have a couple of minutes, unfortunately, to talk about the fact that Dr. Joseph Warren, as tension heats up, insists on being a significant part of the building of militias, and is determined to serve an important function in what would be military resistance to Britain. And of course, this ultimately leads to his death at Bunker Hill. And it is a death that is that occurs under very, very heroic, selfless circumstances. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Well, so I think one of the key things that have been overlooked is that Warren, between the battles of Lexington and Concord and Bunker Hill, is involved in every battle and skirmish that's happening in the Boston area. And you have to think about it. So, you know, where are the other founding fathers? Where's Sam Adams? Where's John Hancock? You know, where's John Adams? Where's Jefferson? Where's Washington? Nobody's there. Warren becomes the on-the-ground leader who's basically taking control of the situation in Boston. I mean, it's his spy network that is gathering the intelligence information and monitoring British troop movements that leads him to send Revere and Dawes on this midnight ride. And I mean, and to me, that it's a misnomer, because it really should be Joseph Warren's ride, because without Warren, this is not happening. I mean, Revere actually, he goes out with Dawes. They meet a third rider who helps to spread the word that the regulars are on the march. But Revere gets captured, and he's detained by British troops. And amazingly, Warren hears that early that morning that eight militiamen are killed on Lexington Green, gets on his horse and leaves to go join the fighting. And he's involved in some of the most heated fighting within the battle that day at Monotony, and he gets his hair shot out from the side of his head by a musket ball. So obviously, when you look at pictures, paintings from that era, they usually tended to roll their hair up in the sides into a curl. And so Warren's almost killed, and it's just amazing to me how Revere kind of gets this popularity and credit. And not to take away from Revere, but we really need to look at Warren's role in that. And that, and you know, that's become known as the shot heard around the world.
Hmm. So in a sense, Warren did not quite attract the headlines that he really warrants.
And I, you know, and I don't mean to say headlines or Warren deserves all this credit. It just, when you see what's happening in the historiography of this Battle of Lexington and Concord, you know, there's several reasons as to why Revere gains the notoriety that Warren does not. And part of it is that Longfellow poem. But when you look at these newspapers and these documents prior to the mid-19th century, you see that Warren is mentioned much more than Revere when it comes to the battles of Lexington and Concord, and then it sort of shifts after that. But I just think it's fascinating that Warren is leading all these events. He becomes president of the Provincial Congress. He's the head of the Committee of Safety. He becomes a Grand Master of the Masons in North America, and he's involved in all these activities. But yet we just know so little about him.
Mm. And I would direct people not only to explore your fascinating book, but also to look up the marvelous painting. I forget the painter's name now. Trumbull, I think, the last name?
John Copley.
Oh, John Copley. The
painted, if we're talking about Warren's portrait, it's Copley and Trumbull.
Right. No, I mean the painting. There's a famous painting of Joseph Warren actually dying at Bunker Hill. The death
that
of
is Trumbull, yes.
Yes.
That is by Jonathan Trumbull, yes.
Right, the death of General Warren at the Battle of Bunker Hill, which in a sense, crystallizes that moment when he loses his life and, in a sense, loses his place with the founding fathers. Or actually, you tell us in the book, he should be thought of as part of the founding grandfathers. I mean, he's really the generation ahead of the founding fathers and such a significant player in what is to ultimately unfold. And the author again is Christian Despina. The title of the book is Founding Martyr, The Life and Death of Dr. Joseph Walker.